Commodity Week is made possible with support from AgriGold Hybrids, funding agricultural programming as an additional service to the many AgriGold customers in the listening area. AgriGold, the corn specialists, on the web at a6395.com and at agrigold.com. And with support from ADM, working with the American farmer, creating products from his crops, creating markets for crops. ADM, resourceful by nature. Commodity Week is a production of listener-supported public radio at the University of Illinois. To learn more, visit us online at will.uiuc.edu.
Welcome to Commodity Week. I'm Todd Gleason. This is a special holiday edition.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Our panelists today are Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services out of Oakland, Illinois, Mike Zuzlo of Risk Management Commodities Incorporated in Lafayette, Indiana, and Dan Zwicker of AgriVisor Services in Bloomington, Illinois. Let's open today's discussion with this question. What is it about the markets in the past year that surprised you most? Paul Cooley.
Well, Todd, I think the big thing that I noticed was that there was a tremendous belief in the marketplace that the corn crop and the bean crop, as far as production numbers, were going to be substantially below what turned out. And, considerably, almost a 1988 type production type mentality. And, quite frankly, when we drove the fields and drove all over the place, we came away with a little different attitude, thank goodness, because my customers seemed to be a little happier and kinder this Christmas than they would have been if I wouldn't have been a little on the bear side.
Most surprising thing for you, Dan?
I don't know if I want to use the word surprising, but a new feature, I think, came to the fold here in 2005, and that was the index fund activity. We begin to see index fund activity take hold shortly after the first of the year, and we saw them to be fairly active buyers of not only ag commodities, but energies and precious metals here to finish out the year. So the index funds, I think they are something that's going to be part of a big part of 2006. It'll be interesting to see how they move their money around from one commodity complex to another commodity complex. But I think that's a feature that is kind of welcomed, I think, for us that are in the ag side of commodities, because it does provide some underlying strength to the marketplace.
And Mike?
I think we learned that in certain times we've always professed, the world market, world factors, world economy, et cetera, currencies. I think at certain times the marketing year, the domestic numbers do trump the world numbers. I think we learned that in September. And thank goodness we reacted quickly after the September report and moved more aggressively on some corn hedges than we were anticipating. But I remember very vividly thinking that it was going to be a year like 1993 in terms of corn yield in the United States, and USDA saying, hey, it's going to be later rather than sooner on the yield reduction, because I really did participate in the idea that the corn yields weren't there after doing all the yield checks. And I think that goes back to the best thing that we put into our analysis for this coming year is I think we do participate more on the idea that these genetics do have more of an artificial intelligence to them, that the plant doesn't cannibalize itself on a drought. It just shuts itself down and can wait itself out longer before it gets into a state where it's really in dire need of rain. And I think that and the ability of planters to put down exactly what you tell them to put down really puts the final population to a number, and the genetics that, and that artificial intelligence that genetics have allowed for those U.S. numbers to be as big as they were. So that's something I think we really have to incorporate in our 06 markets.
Paul, do you think the index funds are a good thing for the marketplace?
Todd, I guess I'm a little concerned about them in some respects, but I think that the commodity exchanges have welcomed them with full openness and feel that the larger volume of trade is necessary to keep the exchanges viable in the world. So I think it's something that we have to observe and play and take advantage of as a commodity trader and marketer of our grain.
Is it okay that the commodity exchanges have privatized?
they've turned themselves into some very the membership and the country club that they're members of it. You know, in professional deal, they've made themselves a lot of money. The mercantile stock has gone up to a tremendous amount. The New York Stock Exchange and, of course, the Board of Trade. It's created a lot of wealth, and it's a new game in that respect.
Yeah, but I asked if it's okay if they privatized.
It's what's happened. You know, I've never won to second guess reality, but it's changed.
It probably hurts the little guy a little bit, but, you know, I think we're of the opinion that the little guy, meaning the ag guys, you know, we've been told for 3 years from our Chicago affiliates and contacts that agricultural side is, you know, not where it's at. You need to be in the currencies, the Forex, the managed accounts and things like that. And I'm encouraged that that's not right. I think I'm in the camp of Dan in that respect, especially because I think this has brought these index funds realize the value of hard assets again. And it's not a just in time commodities, bulk materials, natural resources, you know, they're plentiful, they're ample. That mindset's no longer as present as it was maybe 10 years ago. But, you know, I'm getting a clinic right now in the gold and energy markets because of what they've done. They haven't done it in, literally a quarter of a century. And, you know, I was a youngster when that happened, and I'd really be encouraged to hear any thoughts that Dan or Paul had because I respect them immensely. And their experience on this, I'd really love to know what their feeling is on gold and energies and whether this is the old-time inflation or whether there's something new out there.
Well, I don't know if it's old-time inflation. Of course, everything has changed from 20 years ago or 30 years ago. But there is, I think, a general feeling, especially I think when you look at the macroeconomic situation, is that you do move assets back and forth from stocks to real assets. And I think you look at the 90s run of the stock market. We had cheap interest rates here over the past several years. That hasn't really helped the stock market much. We have recovered a little bit here, but the big go-go days of the 90s, it looks like that's kind of come to an end. During the 90s, when we were shuffling paper from company buyouts and acquisitions here and acquisitions there, we saw that there was no big improvement in our assets, whether it's drilling for more oil, building more refineries, building more fertilizer plants and whatnot. So now I think we're in the phase of a longer type economic cycle that hard assets are going to be the where the action is going to be at for a few years in here, and part of this run up in prices here is not only to basically encourage new facilities, new production, and whatnot. And I think for the next 10 to 20 years, so we do have I think a movement in that direction. But I'm going to be first to say I don't necessarily think it's going to play out like the 70s, but we've got a long ways to go before interest rates go back to 12 or 13 or 14%, and the Fed's already kind of indicated that they're going to start softening or start leveling off on interest rate hikes because you do have parts of the economy that's really booming. You got other parts of the economy that's on the verge of falling off the cliff. So if you start raising interest rates too much, then you get those sectors that are real teeter-totter off the cliff, and then that maybe pulls down the rest of the economy.
I think a person has to focus on energy, energy, and energy, and watch the weather forecast a little bit on the side. But the big factor here is when I look at a piece of farmland, I would not only want it to be productive on top of the ground, I do want it to have at least 5, 5.5 foot of coal under the ground. I think that's where the real money growth is energy. I think the E-mini crude oil contract of $2,500 equals 500 barrels. It's a computer-traded contract. Is a wonderful item. It's about 22,000 gallons of energy as far as gasoline or diesel fuel, heating oil equivalency. We think it's a wonderful way to play the game. People have to be, not only when they wake up in the morning, our surveys indicate the farmer's worried about weather, grain prices, but he also has to take a longer-term look on energy.
And so, and I assume you're talking about in energy, not only coal under the ground, you're talking about hedging fuel cost, I assume, there. And then and I believe you still are, have been a longtime bull of both the ethanol and the biodiesel area.
And I'm a little bit surprised we aren't seeing a bigger boom in the biodiesel because it just equates to a good investment at this time. we understand that there's all kinds of new investments out here in the ethanol side of the equation, and it looks like it's been extremely profitable for those investors.
Well, biodiesel is pretty much a processor situation. So, I mean, if we're going to see any expansion in biodiesel, it's going to have to come from the processors because they're the ones that have the oil. That is something a little different than ethanol, where you can start up your ethanol plant, you can buy the corn, and you can crush it and make your ethanol. When it gets into biodiesel, then you're going to have a soybean crushing plant. So you're going to have to crush that bean, you get your oil, your meal. So that is one of the things that I think you're going to see that, but that's going to come from the processor side of it. It's going to be real hard for farmer initiatives to take place in the biodiesel world like what we've seen in ethanol.
Would it help on the farmer's side if USDA were to change the grading system and they graded on protein and oil?
I don't know. That's out of my league. I don't know if that would make a difference. But what I'm trying to tell you is that the processors now have the facilities. They do the crushing of the soybeans, and they have the oil. So I think, you know, if you're going to see expansion in biodiesel, it's going to have to come from the people that own the processing plants.
You know, I going to the ethanol primarily, one of the things that I've been disheartened by is the so-called environmental movement and talking about how much fossil fuel it takes to make ethanol. But what they don't realize in this cycle is that the seed companies are just now putting the research and development investment money down because production's starting to get to where it's worth the money to the seed companies to pursue better genetics to get more energy. So with the technology comes improved ability to not use as much fossil fuel, and I've really been disappointed, especially in the eastern part of the Corn Belt, at how strong the environmental lobby has been, and it's a so-called environmental lobby, in my opinion, and I guess I'm really kind of ticked off about it, and I hope that changes in 06, that it's kind of like politics, the squeaky wheel gets the grease, the normal, you know, Joe out there who normally doesn't complain about anything is never heard, and it's the 10% or 15% of the group of people out there that are clamoring get everything done their way for a while.
Okay, I want to ask this distinguished panel a question here. You remember when we were brought up and heard all the Purdue University comments about low prices, we'll cure low prices, and we'll get the demand base back. Are we looking at a 1 year, 2 year? When are we going to start seeing better prices, Dan?
Well, the problem we have, I think, in agriculture, and it's a problem, I don't know if I want to call it a problem or not, but when you're dealing with weather as a big variable in production, you can go from feast to famine real quick, and so we've always had some form of farm policy to kind of come in and provide some safety nets. Now, that safety net definition has changed over the years from when we were in high school to what we call to what we have now. But, you know, I think, you know, it's you can see in agriculture it is quite easy to overproduce, exceed demand expectations year in and year out because we're so dependent upon weather. And then this past year, we've seen how the Eastern Corn Belt withstood some of the driest, hottest weather we've seen and still come out with a good yield. But the problem is it's easier to overproduce than to build the demand base. So we always end up with a large supply around. And I think, you know, the fact that you can only grow demand so fast each year, and we've seen here in agriculture that it's we can produce it a whole lot easier sometimes or quicker than what we can use it.
And one question over to Mike Zuzulo. What kind of a grade would you give the American farmer in marketing his grain?
Paul, I think it goes back to the Pareto principle or the 80-20 rule. I think 20% are doing a phenomenal job. I think 80% are doing a mediocre job. And I think a lot of that goes back to the number of people that they listen to. I've noticed in my short tenure of 10 or 11 years as a broker that the producer will read just about everything that's handed to him. And I mean, he'll read 12, 11, 13 different people. And how can you get anything out of 12 or 13 different people, especially in the commodity markets? And until you make a distinct decision to say, this guy's getting a third, this guy's getting a third, and I'm doing a third, how can you make any headway?
Well, that's it. We're closing Commodity Week down. We have too many voices.
Well, the point is, Todd, is somebody's right for everybody, but you can't use 12 people. But, you know, because you have 12 or 15 people, someone will find a niche with one of those guys. And that's what the neat thing about Will Radio. I mean, look at what you guys have done in 05, and look at what Will Radio and this station has been able to exceed expectations, not just meet them, but exceed them. And the panel meetings are as good as they were, you know, 5 or 10 years ago in terms of number of people coming. So my opinion is that everybody has one shoe fits somebody, and that's what's so nice about the kind of the buffet we have here.
Yeah, I kind of like the fact that here on the radio station that I do the afternoon, Dave does the morning, and I like to think of Dave Dickey, who's the director of ag programming here, kind of as a day trader because he's in the market. He follows it all day long. And he likes to do that. He's done a phenomenal job. He's a day trader, and I tend to be more of a hedger and think longer term. And if you listen to the questions that we're asking the panelists, they reflect those things. And I think if you listen in the morning to Dave and in the afternoon to me, then you're probably getting a pretty good idea of what you guys are really thinking about on both sides of those markets, whether you're a day trader or a hedger. On a different subject, what is the common characteristic, and this follows up, Paul, on the question that you just asked, what's the common characteristic of the clients that you have that are most successful? What makes a successful farmer client for you?
I think it just simply boils down to communication. I think that the more you discuss things, and I think if in my job, if I listen more than I talk, which is very difficult, if I listen more than I talk, we end up communicating very, very well. And if they listen more than they talk, we end up doing very, very well with each other because we've met each other's expectations. Why? Because we knew what each other's expectations were to start with. That's what drives me the baddiest of signing up a new client is that one guy's on one side and the other guy's on the other side, and you can't do it that way.
Nerves of steel, and they've grown into this success, and they usually have a little higher intelligence. And they get up early, and they watch every aspect of it, and they're good learners. But I will say that several are watching professional marketing services.
I guess I want to take a little different twist to that is the ones that I think do a little better job of marketing their grain are the ones that probably don't have much storage. I've watched that now ever since I got into market advisory business in the middle 70s is that the ones that don't have storage are the ones that don't have that backup, so to speak. So they're more alert. They look more ahead and think and say, hey, listen, I don't have any storage for this crop. So they're going to be more apt to pull the trigger because they know they don't have no backup plan. Whereas the ones that have storage, they kind of get into the mold. Well, there'll be another opportunity. I'll just put it in the bin. So I would say the ones that have done a little better job or seem to do a little better job than the ones that don't have storage because they're thinking ahead all the time because they get their crops sold. So they're not worrying about old crop. So they can continue to look ahead all the time. And I think that is key because when you've got old crop to market, a lot of times you'll miss the opportunities on the new because you're too busy marketing the old. Whereas if you got that sold, by the time you get done with harvest, then you're looking ahead. So those are the ones I think do a little better job of marketing. And they have an edge because they're not worrying about holding old crop inventory.
Interesting. We have a longtime listener who he farms, his wife does the marketing, and he swears that because his wife does the marketing, she says it's because of this reason. He's in love with his crop, and he won't sell it, but she doesn't care, and she knows what the money needs, and she sells it. And he swears that she does a much better job of marketing the crop for that very reason. And it's, I suppose, kind of similar to having the bin and going, well, there she is. I'll just pat it, and it's still there. It's still safe. and I can sell it later.
Well, I think, you know, a number one requirement to be a farmer, you have to be bullish. that spills over into everything. They love to buy. They love to buy farmland. They love to buy green equipment, maybe some red equipment once in a while. They love to be buyers. They're bullish on everything, and I think maybe that makes them I think you have to be a bullish person to go through all the work of raising a crop, of all the stress and the worry and the money that you have to borrow to put it in the ground in the spring and go through all the weather scares and watch the rains miss you, whatever. You have to be an optimistic type person. So I think that what probably makes them not a good seller. They're good buyers, but when it comes to selling, they have some difficulty, and that's maybe where the wife can kind of help them out. She's maybe looking at something to spend that money on, and she's willing to sell it.
I think one rule that I'm starting to look at and reinvent every year is you better be out of long corn of old crop at least by the last week in July, and you better be out of those old soybeans by the first week of August. You know, you just have to clean the deal, and this year is another example that you got to empty the bins before. Not wait to the end.
On the corn, is that because of LDP?
I think it's a case where, you know, we're getting closer to harvest all the time, and it's just a place where it's carryover and dumping inventory and maybe grain under loan and another crop coming on. But there's just a certain time you got to start pulling the trigger, Todd.
Tell me about farmland investments.
Well, I'll tell you this. I heard Dan's point earlier, and it struck a note. Part of the reason I think gold's being bought so aggressively is a lack of confidence in the large countries' currencies, that this big debt that we're carrying as countries like Japan and like the United States and Germany and France and the petrodollars that have been invested into U.S. bonds have kept the interest rates low. And maybe artificially low, and I'm worried that especially in the second half of 2006, we're going to see interest rates really start to climb, because these people, like the Asians, are buying gold because they're nervous about the currencies, whether it's the euro, the dollar, or the yen. They're all worried that there's no real upside to these, and so they're going to the gold saying, I'm going to protect my dollar assets by buying this hard asset of gold. And that usually historically doesn't bode well for what's down the line in interest rates a year, year and a half later. And so if we can't get the dollar, the euro, the yen to rally, and we see crude oil prices start to drop, I'm really nervous that maybe these Asian countries that have been buying our debt, these Middle Eastern countries have been buying our dollar because they have no other money to put it anywhere else, that's going to stop and our interest rates are going to start to climb. So I'm cautious, Todd, on the second half of 2006.
Land's an interesting commodity, you know, and I think what we're seeing, I think land prices have a long ways to go to the upside. Now, like I mentioned earlier, is I think we got a long ways to go before we go to 12 or 15 or 16% interest, and whether or not we'll repeat that cycle or not, I don't know, but I suspect we will someday. But land, there's a group of people out there, and I guess I consider I'm one of them, is that I want to own land to have space. I'm a farm boy that grew up in the country, moved to the city, raised a family in the city, and got neighbors and neighbors and neighbors, and now I'm to the point where I'm ready to go back to my roots in a way, go back to the farm, get some space, and not have to contend with all the hassles of the city. And I think this is something that my wife and I, we're looking at buying property in Texas. We're going to go down to Texas after I retire. The land down there that doesn't grow anything is coastal. They don't raise alfalfa down there. They got coastal hay, and it's kind of a grass that grows on top of the dirt because there's just not enough moisture. That land is $5,000 an acre. So when I take a look at that and then I come up here and look at this black soil, I go, why isn't it selling for $10,000 an acre? So I think but one thing that you see in Texas is a growing state. Now, Illinois grows, but it's mostly a shrinking state because everybody's moving south because of warmer weather. But this land thing, I think, has got a ways to go yet.
Yeah, I'd rather have 640 acres of Illinois farmland than 1,000 of that $5,000 acre.
Yeah, but you got to understand, people are buying this not to raise anything on it but grass. They just want space.
I read an article in the Wall Street Journal that English have learned a long time ago the West way to become noble is own a farm. You gain respect and nobility, and there's a lot of truth to that. And the other old wise tale of mine is that if you own 1,000 acres, everybody in the county knows your first and last name, but if you're $4 million in CDs in a bank, nobody will know your name.
We've got about 4 minutes left. What topics haven't we discussed that you think you put on your list of things that for the end of the year that we really ought to take up? We've done energies. We've done the land. We've talked not much about the grains and oil seeds, but we don't know what the markets did in the past week, and I really didn't want to pick that up because this will air on Christmas Day and on New Year's Day. So it does repeat if you happen to be listening to this program thinking, I heard that last week. In fact, you did. So what topics might we take up yet, Paul?
Well, I think it's only right that the distinguished panel needs to talk about what's the best technical trading idea that they have, quickly, and tell us just exactly where we go.
Let's start with you.
Well, I think the best one that I've watched is follow the trend, follow the 40-day moving average, and it's a pretty good tool and crutch to watch.
Dan?
Well, I think for something simple, I've seen some people just plain watch the RSI. When it gets down into the lower level, whether it's 25 or 20%, you just walk away from the market and don't make any sales at that point in time. But when it's up in the 70s and 80s, you need to make some sales. You can do that. Now, that's an old technical system that has been around for years. It was one of the first ones out. I've talked to a lot of farmers that just watch that RSI to market their grain, and I'm not too sure that ain't something to do at. But, moving averages are good. Trend lines are good. Draw some trend lines on weekly charts, weekly and monthly charts, and if those trend lines begin to get validated, that is telling you that the trend is shifting. And I know those are easier said than done. But I think farmers also need to take a look at mechanical trading systems that just do a sales each month to help them along to maybe get something sold. Then they can maybe use the futures market, the options market, work with brokers, whatnot, to maybe protect those sales that are on the books. But there's a lot of different things. I get into a little more sophisticated. I get into a particular point, how patterns work inside a time frame. But
and Mike Zuzulo.
Well, I think probably the momentum side of the equation is the most I struggle with, Todd, because once markets start to move, are you leaving too much money on the table? And what we tend to do is look at the daily chart. If it exceeds our expectations or moves to new highs, go to the weekly and then the weekly to the monthly, and that helps to get the momentum going.
Gentlemen, we appreciate you being with us. Thank you very much for joining us.
Merry Christmas, Todd.
Merry Christmas to you. We do appreciate having you on board for not only this program, but for all season long. We hope that you've enjoyed it, and we look forward to talking to each and you during your regular Commodity Week and Closing Market Report appearances. Paul Cooley on Wednesday, Dan Zwicker on Thursday, and Mike Zuzulo on Fridays. Thanks much for joining us for this edition of Commodity Week. I'm Todd Gleason.
Commodity Week is made possible with support from AgriGold Hybrids, funding agricultural programming as an additional service to the many AgriGold customers in the listening area. AgriGold, the corn specialists, on the web at a6395.com and at agrigold.com. And with support from ADM, working with the American farmer, creating products from his crops, creating markets for crops. ADM, resourceful by nature.